So indeed, I will be talking about some stringy mechanisms for space-time singularity resolution. I'd like to emphasize, even though it's not very popular to these days to have a middle initial W, to emphasize that I am not the actress, Amanda Peet. So anybody who's come to this talk in the expectation of seeing a Hollywood-style production is likely to be very disappointed. Okay, that part over now, and people can leave if they want to. See, I'm just giving you an opportunity here. You should take it. Don't worry, I know how. I've recently moved to the University of Toronto, and just like to point out for those of us who have Irish blood at the bottom that I do actually have green socks on today. Okay, so I'm going to be talking mainly about things that, with other collaborators, we've dubbed enhance-ons, so those of you who are real experts in the subject can go to sleep and I'll wake you up when there are new things to talk about. There are various collaborators that have been talking to considerably about all of the issues that I'll be discussing, most particularly Joe Polchinski, also postdoc Alex Buchel at ITP, Clifford Johnson and Simon Ross, who are now faculty at Durham, and Rob Myers, who is sort of not quite at McGill and moving to the Perimeter Institute. So just a very sort of general first transparency to set the scene a little bit. It's no accident that this is actually the name of the Aspen workshop this summer. So I'll just mention that there is this thing we called string theory, which I like to call the elephant, in the sense that we only have a handle on maybe the tail of it at the moment. We have made a lot of discoveries over the last 6 years or so in string theory by taking parameters to extremes. For example, when we took the strong coupling limit of type 2A, we didn't get some disgusting singularity, we got an extra dimension. We also took the string coupling to zero for systems, BPS systems, and enabled us to compute Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for black holes using microphysics. In other circumstances, we've taken the stringiness parameter to zero while keeping Yang-Mills couplings on brains fixed and obtained gravity gauge correspondences. In other circumstances, we've taken stringiness parameters to zero but kept Nevers-Schwartz B potentials fixed and got non-commutative theories of various kinds. So in many of these circumstances, what we've been doing is starting with what you might refer to as fundamental Lego blocks, fundamental strings, DP brains, Nevers-Schwartz 5 brains, and the surprise in some sense is by taking extreme limits of this elephant does not actually result in singularities, but rather new relationships between old things, if you like. So one example of this, which I'll sort of concentrate on in my talk, is the gravity gauge correspondences, such as the ADS-CFT correspondence, which the speaker before lunch happily did some introduction for. And in this circumstance, we have an actual realization of something that was called the holographic principle. I actually don't think it's a principle. It was a conjecture. But now we actually, in the string theoretic context, actually have a real realization of this idea that was motivated by looking at the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and seeing that it scaled like the area, not the volume, that at the higher dimensional theory with gravity should perhaps be dual to a lower dimensional quantum field theory, and we have string theories on ADS, for example, times a sphere being dual to field theory. Now, this gives us, this classical quantum duality, gives us a context in which to explore some of the puzzles that have really interested me, the black hole information problem. In this context, there is actually an in-principle resolution. I can discuss that in the question period if people want me to say more about that. But also more what I'll concentrate on today is provides, in certain circumstances, ways for resolving space-time singularities. So what is the problem with space-time singularities? Isn't it just obvious that string theory should somehow fix them all and we should all just be done and go home? Well, classical string or M theory is, at least in cases where we've got some supersymmetry, supergravity. And when we're looking for various space-times that are exerted by collections of brains or whatever, when we're looking for space-times solving the supergravity equations of motion, we're aided by no-hair theorems, which say that as long as we've got a bunch of conserved quantum numbers that are characterizing our space-time, and any singularity that we find is behind the horizon, then that space-time geometry is unique. So if we find by some happy accident very easily some space-time, then we know we've got the right one. Now, unfortunately, though, these no-hair theorems break down if the singularities are naked. And what happens in this circumstance is that the entire geometry is questioned, not just the bit near the naked singularity. And that's an important point. In this quest for finding spacetimes that are relevant to various situations in string theory, we find both clothed singularities with null, time-like, and space-like singularities. We get them all. And people have also found what look like naked singularities. So all of these things occur. So this is sort of like the quest, you know, what happens in classical string theory. Now, Horowitz and Myers pointed out about 6 years ago or so that there's a very important point that string theory, or M theory in its quantum incarnation, can fix singularities in two different ways. The first one is the one that everybody imagines what will happen. You'll smooth these out. Space-time is sort of breaking down once the curvature gets to be too stringy. Space-time is the wrong description. What we should actually use is some other set of degrees of freedom, which, given the fixed conserved quantum numbers, we can figure out for a given system. But in fact, that's not the only way that string theory can say something about space-time singularities. There are some that are just illegal. String theory must prevent them ab initio. And the canonical example of this is to look at a negative mass Schwarzschild black hole. Pick any dimension you like, 4 dimensions, 10 dimensions, whatever flips your switch. And then you can ask, well, in this case, the radius of the horizon in the Schwarzschild coordinate should be -2 × times the Newton constant times the value of the mass. And unfortunately, that's sort of inside where the naked singularity at arc L0 occurs. So suppose that string theory would say, well, this naked point singularity is somehow resolved out into some, you know, stringy mass or something. Then, unfortunately, what we would have is a blob here. This blob is the resolution, which has a negative mass. That's not something you change because you haven't changed the asymptotics of the geometry, which is how we measure ADM mass. And then, unfortunately, the vacuum, which is nothing, would be unstable into falling apart into a bunch of these blobs. So you can argue just from the stability of the vacuum that string theory does not allow this resolution. This naked classical singularity, imagining that it would get resolved somehow, that's just a figment of a classical physicist's imagination. So there's two different ways that string theory can resolve singularities. And by the way, some of the early examples of so-called geometries that were dual to so-called renormalization group flows of field theories in the ADS-CFT correspondent suffered from this problem, that they were actually figments of classical people's imaginations. Okay, so to get started on how string theory might have something to say about resolution of space-time singularities, I just start with a fairly simple example, which I've referred to as plain Jane D-brains, just D-brains that are living in with a flat R1P world volume, or else maybe they're wrapped on a torus, but it's generally easier if they're not. So as the Skinderis mentioned, the physics becomes simpler in the decoupling limit. What happens here is that the interactions between the open strings who end on the brains and the closed strings that live in the bulk, they don't interact anymore. And then you've got sort of two separate descriptions of the same physics. One of them is the brain theory, and for general P plus one dimensional theory, it's not a conformal field theory, but it's some supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory which has, in D equals 4 language, N equals 4 supersymmetry. So this is maximal supersymmetry for the theory on the brains. There is also the bulk supergravity description, and as Skinderis mentioned, the asymptotically flat region of the geometry is gone in the decoupling limit. And so then you can ask, well, what would be the measures of quantum corrections for the supergravity geometry? How would we know where it becomes unhinged, places where we shouldn't be using the supergravity description anymore? And you can look at the string coupling constant multiplied by e to the phi. This tells you how strong the string loop corrections are. And you can look at some curvature invariant with enough powers of alpha prime to make it a dimensionless number and ask that that might be your measure of how badly alpha prime corrections are needed, how stringy the curvature has become. So for the case where you have P brains with P less than 3, you find that the curvature blows up far out in the geometry. That's not something that happens in the asymptotically flat geometry. The reason why this singularity actually occurs is that in the decoupling limit, you chopped off that asymptotically flat region. So the geometry actually does blow up at infinity in terms of the curvature, and the dilaton blows up near the center at r equals 0. U is just this radial coordinate, which is the usual radial coordinate used in these decoupling limit geometries. For the cases of the p-brains with p bigger than 3, the curvature blows up the origin and the dilaton blows up far away. So then there's this more famous example of 3 brains. In this case, at least with a BPS system, the geometry is ADS5 cross S5 everywhere. So there's no sort of distinction of where the blowing upping occurs based on radius. It's a thing that occurs everywhere. The supergravity is good in this case if the... So these corrections are small when the gauge coupling and the number of brains, the rank of the gauge group, is big. So as long as your parameters are fixed, you're okay in that case. What you do with the... So if, for example, you wanted to find the supergravity geometry is very strongly curved, all you would need to do would be use weakly field theory. So what happens in the cases where P is not 3, was provided by Itzaki Maldus and Asano Shani Yankelevitz in a 98 paper, and they showed that precisely where the curvature blows up, for example, these cases, and these blow-ups here, is precisely where the Yang-Mills theory becomes weakly coupled. So yes, in that case, the curvature singularities are resolved, because what you find when you get too close to, say, the origin for this case, is that you should actually use the description of the physics in terms of the super Yang-Mills theory. So in the decoupling limit, at least, and perhaps in a more general sense, you can say that this super Yang-Mills theory resolves some null DP brain singularities, for example, for the big brains. This is the most clear for 4 brains and 5 brains, for example. Now, I'll just mention one small thing about 6 brains. We don't understand the correspondences, these gravity gauge correspondences, very well for that case, for one thing, because the decoupling actually doesn't occur for 6 brains. But I'll just mention a curious fact about the 6-brain geometries that's not commonly known, is that these null singularities are actually naked in the following sense. You know, when you have a singularity and a horizon happening at the same place, you always wonder, that's sort of on the borderline of being naked. I mean, how do we decide whether it's sort of like naked or not? And one of the ways that you might analyze that is to say, I want to ask that a photon that tries to come out from the singularity shouldn't make it to me in a finite affine parameter. That's true for 5 or less brains, but for 6 brains it's actually not true. So there's something doubly screwed up about the 6 brains. Okay, now, in the case of... One can also ask questions about the finite temperature story. And the easiest case here is, again, the 3 brains. So what happens when you ask, if I make these brains non-extremal, add a certain amount of energy to them, what happens? Well, in the decoupling limit, I get a black hole in the interior of ADS5. It's an asymptotically ADS black hole times the phi sphere. And there is a space-like singularity at the origin of the space-time. So sort of in principle, by using the gravity gauge correspondence, you have a sort of a resolution of the space-time singularity, space-like singularity, but it's pretty hard to understand exactly how this happens. So I think it's fair to say that not a great deal is actually really well understood about that yet. But somebody in the audience might have a comment about that. So, okay, about the enhanceon, which is the stuff that we developed. This was basically one more step in the story of trying to understand resolution of space-time singularities by using the decoupling limit to look at correspondences with gauge theories. And the next less amount of supersymmetry than n equals 4 is n equals 2. And there's several ways you can achieve this. I mean, there's many different realizations of n equals 2 gauge theory with no hypermultiplets, by the way, just plain old n equals 2. By using intersecting brains. From the supergravity point of view, this is actually more difficult to construct the solutions because there's less symmetry. You typically have, you know, intersecting brains or things like this, and it's hard to understand, although there has been some progress made on that recently, for example, by Fayazuddin and Smith and their collaborators, although there are actually some aspects of those geometries which are still quite puzzling. And another way to get less supersymmetry is to wrap brains instead of on tori, in which case you don't break any additional supersymmetry, but you wrap on some manifold and you have some... The supersymmetry is incompatible. Some of the supersymmetries are incompatible with that wrapping, and so you break them. The simplest example, the first one that we looked at, was to take some D brains and just wrap them on a K3, a four-dimensional manifold, and this breaks half the supersymmetry. Turns out, for various technical reasons, that the case of the 6-brain is simplest. For the case of 7 brains or larger, you actually would want a 7-brain if you wanted to end up, if the K3 is sort of small, with a 3 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory, but these supergravity geometries are not asymptotically flat, and we didn't know how to handle the case of lots and lots of seven brains. Also, if you use brains that are smaller than the six brains, the field theories that you obtain in the duality have very wild infrared fluctuations, and it's not clear that you can really interpret what comes out, so that's why the six brain was the simplest. So how do you find the solution? Well, as usual with at least the ways I've seen this approached in string theories, you make some naive guess, or you use some duality, you say, I think this is what the solution is. And what you find is that the geometry you get when you make this naive guess has a time-like naked singularity. And what we found, as I'll discuss in a little bit, the mechanism, it's actually resolved via a phenomenon what you call the enhancon, and there's a little cedilla under here because otherwise it would be an enhancon. So I should mention that Joe, when he wrote put this name in the paper the first time, put a little stroke through it like sense, because he thought that was the way to put a soft C, but I reminded him that there was actually another way of doing it. Okay, so there are several other examples of how to see resolution of space-time singularities. One of them, it was discussed in a paper of Polchinski and Strassler using Myers' dielectric brain expansion story. That was an N equals 1 supersymmetric story. There's been an awful lot of work on this since this. I just wanted to concentrate on a simple one, partly because it was one that I was actually involved with. These go by various other names like cascades and transgressions and so forth. It's become quite an industry to understand certain dualities and on the way get information about how to resolve space-time singularities. So what are the basic ideas behind the analysis that we did? Well, there are really two of them. The first basic idea is that if you get some space-time geometry that's exerted by these fundamental Legos like strings or brains or whatever, then they should have a resolution. Any singularities that you get should have a resolution because, if you like, string theory knows what to do in extreme situations, small cycles, orbifolds, that kind of thing. The second basic idea behind what we were talking about is that if you have different probes, so if you probe the graviton or a string or a brain, you generally see different physics. Now, that seems kind of obvious, but it's going to have some interesting consequences, and some people have not truly appreciated this, I think. Example, of course, of where the fact different probes see different physics. Different physics for different probes. Yes, well. There is a minimum distance phenomenon if you just take a fundamental string and wrap it on a plain old circle, and you see that you can't really probe distances shorter than the string scale. Of course, that you get a different answer if you wrap on some more interesting compactification. But if you ask, suppose you take some D0 brain probes and ask what's the basic sort of length scale that they see in physics, it has a power of G string in front of it, so typically these two length scales can be very different. So what we asked in order to see whether this geometry that we had up here was really singular or not, to find out whether it was one of those figments of a classical physicist's imagination or whether it was resolvable, we actually probed it with the same object that the singular geometry is made of. So let me just give a short review of this enhancon story. So the main thing, this was in the paper with Clifford and Joe, the main thing that happens when you wrap six brains on a K3 surface, or any bigger brains on a K3 surface, is because it's curved, there are some extra pieces that occur in the actions brains, and you induce some P-4 brain charge. In this case, it's a D2 brain, and you end up getting a minus sign for that charge. And you make this guess that the classical geometry is just as if you build, as in the other cases with BPS brains, this is a supersymmetric situation, you build it from harmonic functions. And if there's a harmonic function describing the six-brain aspect of the physics, this is the H6 here, and there's also a harmonic function that describes this D2 brain charge, which are actually effectively smeared all over the K3. So this is the ansatz that you make for the geometry. There are also Ramond-Ramond and Dilton fields turned on, and they look just pretty much like what you have in the normal brains on tori cases. Now, in the decoupling limit, the harmonic function for the six brain loses the 1 in front, and it just has the behavior of 1 over u, 1 over the radius, as usual. But you find that the harmonic function for the effective smeared two brains here has a minus sign in it. And this thing comes from, you have to have this minus sign in here in order to recover the correct formula for the ADM tension or the ADM mass of this geometry. So that's partly how we knew that that was the answer, because we said, well, this thing has got to have the right mass. How can we cook up the harmonic functions, which are solutions of Laplace equations, to actually have the right behavior? And this minus does come from this effective minus charge here. Also, the gauge theory that this system will be dual to, as long as we don't have too much energy to excite excitations actually involving momentum on the K3, not that there's actually a U1 isometry, but the Itauf coupling is built out of some fundamental parameters, including the number of brains. Now, this solution here is singular when this harmonic function here has a zero. For example, the radius of the transverse spheres, because there's a square root of H6 in front, goes to zero when this whole thing is equal to zero. And this is called the repulsion radius, and it's the Itauf coupling divided by 2. By the way, this is called the repulsion not because it's disgusting, which it is, so it's repulsive.
How many dimensions are the first radius?
Okay, sorry, there are three here, because there are two...
Not 11.
No, this is parallel, sorry, beg your pardon. So there's time and two dimensions along the would-be D2 brains, and then there's four dimensions in the K3. Transverse, there's one radial, and there's a two-sphere. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. It is ambiguous the way I've written it. So I was mentioning that this thing is called the repulsion. It was dubbed that by Kalosh and Linde, who actually studied a related geometry. Actually, it's essentially equivalent under a duality. This whole system of wrapping D6 brains on a K3 via a sequence of T and S dualities, you can turn it into the system of a heterotic string wrapped on a circle. The chain of dualities you use is actually fairly simple. But anyway, the point was that they took the geometry of the heterotic string, has a momentum number plus 1 and a winding number minus 1, and they analyzed the motion of massive particles in this geometry, and they found out that they were repelled by the singularity, which is why they called it the repulsion. So, so that's got a singularity and it's at a big radius, because this Itauf coupling in the supergravity case can be quite large. Now, the horizon is the place where the coefficient of dr squared goes to infinity. By the way, it's actually not generically the place where the coefficient of dt squared goes to zero, because those are not the same in the case where you don't have a static geometry. So the place where GRR blows up is the horizon, and that's at u equals zero. So unfortunately, that's inside the location of the singularity, and so the singularity is naked. Now, in the original paper, we might have mentioned, or in a talk, that this was at a big finite radius, so it's sort of on a sphere. But in fact, since the components of the metric for the spheres actually go to zero at the repulsion, it's a point singularity, and there's no sense of being able to go inside this nasty, disgusting place. So how do we find out that this singularity is actually resolved? Well, the way I mentioned before is that we take a probe who's exactly the same as the guys that are giving rise to this geometry, and we ask, how does this probe behave in this background? So was there a question there, or is it resolved? Okay. So you just write down the action for a probe brain or a test brain in the supergravity background, and because of the curvature of the K3, there are some extra bits and pieces to the brain action than what it is for just flat brains. And you find for the Lagrangian there's some constant piece, which just is actually the value of the BPS tension of the thing. And then there is a half the velocity squared. This is in the slow motion approximation. And then there's a piece that sort of looks like a tension, but it actually has a radial dependence. There's a 1 over u in here. So you see far away, this piece isn't going to be important, but as you come further and further into the geometry, then you find that it really matters. And what you find is that this moduli space metric, this thing you pull off, which is the coefficient of VIVJ, it goes to zero at a certain radius, which we called the enhancement radius, which was twice the radius of the repulsion. And that factor of 2 is very robust. It happens for any of the different P brains, and it's definitely there. Yeah, we checked it many different ways.
Just passes the Dyson's field, because Dyson...
Yeah, can you just let me get to it before you start interjecting? Thank you. So what's going on here is that effectively the effect of D6 brain wrapped on K3, the probe tension goes to zero at the enhanceon radius. For those of you that see the duality to the heterodicon circle case, this is the case where the radius goes to itself dual radius. And we know that if you have a momentum plus one winding minus one string wrapped on a thing of self dual radius, it goes to zero tension. At that point, it's a W boson of the enhanced SU2 symmetry. And that's why we called it an enhanceon, because there is an SU2 symmetry at this locus. And what you find via various arguments, essentially it's related to the fact that there's no meaning for a circle of smaller than the string scale in that heterodic dual story, that you can't move this probe brain inside the enhanceon locus. And so what you realize then is that you can't actually build this singular geometry. Now, I just mention here that it's important that this enhanceon radius has a thing that's proportional to the number of brains. So let's imagine, can we build a geometry which has this nasty, horrible, disgusting repulsion singularity in it? We take a brain. We bring in a probe. We ask, how close can he get? Well, he can't go infinitely close. He comes to the enhanceon radius and he stops. And then you ask, suppose I bring in another guy, and you find that it can't also get in very, very close. So eventually what happens is that you don't have all of the brains sitting in the middle of space-time. In fact, they sit on a sphere. And this could be called a Dyson sphere of brains. That's just a Star Trek reference more than anything. But what it tells you, because in fact these functions that describe the metric that we talked about before are solutions of a Laplace equation, we can just use a Gauss's law argument to say that the space-time inside is flat. And in particular, the piece of the geometry that corresponded to that naked singularity is just gone. It's not there. So this is a resolution of the space-time singularity of this geometry. And in fact, there is a duality here. And on the gauge theory side, it's a little more complicated than the case of the flat brains, and I won't go into it because I haven't got time. But you can see this brain expansion story as a non-perturbative thing that happens, and you can see it via the Zeiberg-Witten curve. Perturbatively, all of the brains can sit at the origin, but once you turn the non-perturbative physics, you generate the scale here that tells you that the brains actually have to be separated, and there is no enhanced gauge symmetry. It's broken into a bunch of U1s in the non-perturbative, in the strong coupling limit, which is what you expect to correspond to the classical supergravity. So that's all very cool. It's really old stuff, but it is a nice singularity resolution story. Now, I'd just like to mention some more recent stuff that we've been talking about for asking what happens when you make this thing go finite temperature. Should be written up relatively soon by Johnson and Myers and Ross and myself. We actually can't wait to write a paper with some sort of stretch strings and stuff in it, because we have J, M, P, and R, and we want to call them jumper cables. But, okay, bad joke. Now, when you have a non-extremal brain or a non-PPS DB brain, one way that you can encode what happens to the harmonic function in this case is that there is an extra piece that goes in front of the usual form of the BPS harmonic function. You also have to multiply the time and radial components by a function that tells you that you've got a black hole-y thing in there, and that this is in the decoupling limit when, in fact, the one is gone from the harmonic function. You also have to divide the Ramond-Ramond form by this alpha factor. And it would be one in the BPS limit, but when you've turned on the non-BPS, the finite temperature story, it's different. And this R0 is the radius of the horizon. So as the radius of the horizon goes to zero, alpha goes to one, while when R0 is much bigger than the BPS effective radius here, then this alpha thing actually goes to zero, although it's not totally obvious in the way it's written here. Now, this is what normally happens for a regular type of brain. Well, what happens when we study our non-extremal enhanceon geometry? Well, there's a funny minus sign that occurred in the harmonic function for the two brain, and then with the fact that the mass of the non-BPS configuration should be bigger, in fact, you find is that the little alpha function here for the six brains is obeying this normal thing, that it's between 0 and 1. But in fact, because of that funny minus sign, the little alpha thing for the harmonic function of the effect of two brains actually gets a strange plus sign in it. And as a result of this, the alpha 2 parameter, instead of running between 1 and 0, actually runs between 1 and infinity. And then that, then you find that all sorts of strange things happen, like the location where the another probe brain would go tensionless is actually bigger than the BPS case. The radius of the repulsion is greater than the place where you would imagine the horizon to be. That actually corrects a typo in the original paper, by the way. So you can actually compute the potential energy and the kinetic energy for the probe. This is what it looks like for the probe, and that's how we found where the enhancement story was, and you can find out the potential energy, and because of this weird sign and the alpha thing running between 1 and infinity, you can find out that the potential energy is actually attractive, as you would expect, things like to black holes. Okay, so what we find is that the enhancement radius is always outside where you might have expected the horizon to be. The potential is monotonic all the way to the enhancement. A recent analysis where we looked at matching conditions in supergravity, you say, well, if I had a certain geometry out to that enhancement radius, do I actually have flat space inside or not? And we've done the analysis, at least we found one solution. It's not clear if it's unique. It looks like the space-time inside is actually just the black hole space-time. But to figure out exactly whether this is the right way to distribute the entropy of the situation or whether there are some other degrees of freedom that also share the entropy or maybe even dominate it, that's something that we haven't quite worked out.
What
yes.
Finite temperature here?
What is the temperature? It's related to the U0 parameter, which is the thing that tells you how big the... So I had a non-extremality function in my thingy here. The Hawking temperature is expressible in terms of that, and it's proportional to a positive power of it. So when U0 goes to zero, the Hawking temperature also goes to zero. So you can talk about the limit as you get back the BPS geometry if you want to.
What you're describing, then, is the temperature...
No, it's a function of temperature.
Yeah, but the qualitative behavior.
Here we don't have a chiral symmetry story like in the more recent examples that Buechel and Klebanov and so forth have been talking about.
I thought that the enhanced geometry has some intrinsic scale to it.
Yes. And so that's the size of the shell. Right.
And so there's no qualitative difference when the energy, temperature is
right,
lower.
Right, right. In fact, one of the things you might wonder is if you turn up the temperature, maybe the black hole sort of pops outside the enhancement.
Yeah.
That actually never happens. That's an interesting point.
The horizon always stays inside.
Well, the would-be horizon, the place where you probably thought it was going to be, and if you actually patch in the black hole inside, it actually is. There's a little black hole inside the piece of sort of... it's roughly flat space, but it's not. It's got a black hole. Right, but this is sort of preliminary results, so I don't want to make too categorical a statement. We're still checking. Right, but that's actually a thing. I mean, it's actually kind of non-trivial that there is this funny minus sign occurring in this little alpha parameter for the two brains. This is what leads to the horizon, the would-be horizon, always being inside the place where the probe becomes tensionless. And if you be a bit careless about the equations of motion and don't follow the signs right, you realize that, you don't get this actual plus sign.
This is for one particular p equals 6.
Yeah, but you can do the analysis like this for any other different p, and it's the same story.
Yes. What happens if you take a thing and you keep dumping energy in?
Actually, the horizon gets very big. It is kind of...
But it can't move outside the enhancement radius. So
not as far as... No.
According to this proposal. So,
right.
So what happens? Do the brains sort of keep on getting pushed to some... Horizon must grow.
Yes, but so does the enhancement.
So
the location where a zero-temperature probe goes tensionless also grows with the temperature. So I don't want to spend, huge... I did have something else to say. We can discuss that a little more. It is a bizarre geometry from the point of view of what you're used to, but that's basically because of this weird wonky minus sign that occurs in the two-brain harmonic function. It turns upside down some of your intuition about finite temperature supergravity solutions, in particular what happens with this little alpha parameter. By the way, if this alpha parameter didn't run between 1 and infinity instead of 1 and 0, the potential wouldn't be attractive in some position. There's a lot of sort of checks that you can do that indicate that actually it is the right solution. But I don't want to get too deeply into that. So for the remainder of the time, I'd like to discuss actually something a little older than these more recent results, which is a connection between the n equals 4 correspondence and the n equals 2 correspondence. This was work that was finished last fall with Buchel and Polchinski. So luckily, Costas did most of the introduction regarding perturbing the ADS-CFT correspondence, so I don't have to go through it too much. Basically, the idea is that if you perturb with some conformal field theory operator, as long as it's relevant or marginal, you don't mess up the fact that you have ADS at infinity. And what this is supposed to be telling you is how to write down some supergravity geometry that, at least in a rough sense, is dual to renormalization group flow between the n equals 4 superconformal field theory in the ultraviolet to some more interesting field theory with less supersymmetry in the infrared. And I'll just make one comment that is obvious to those who are in the know, but it has some interesting consequences for questions of background independence and so forth, that when you do this decoupling limit here, you really clamp down the space-time asymptopia, at least in the case where you're looking at a sector or string theory where you have D3 brain charge N and no other charge. It's got to be ADS5 times S5, and there's no way to sort of change that in the regime where you have a correspondence. Okay, so the solution that was found by Christoph Pilk and Nick Warner, and it was a real beast. Okay, so these guys are supergravity, you know, experts and can do all sorts of magic with this sort of thing that gives me stomach aches to try to read about it. But it's real tour de force calculations. And what they were looking at is what was the supergravity dual to when you turned on a certain perturbation in the gauge theory. If the X is the adjoint scalars, this is the particular bosonic operator that you give a VEV to, and then there are also some accompanying fermionic pieces. Essentially, it corresponds to giving two of the fermions that you've got a mass. And they looked at finding a supergravity solution that was dual to this story, the thing that would describe the flow from n equals 4 to n equals 2, and it was called n equals 2 star. Essentially because the breaking parameter, you couldn't make it arbitrarily large, but that's a detail. So they used a thing called the consistent truncation ansatz for the supergravity, and it was, you know, as I said, really evil, but real tour de force calculations. In this case, their solution actually has a finite number of integration constants. They had to solve some differential equations, but the gauge theory moduli space actually has a lot more parameters. And so what the Pilk-Warner solution is telling you about, it turns out, after you look at it, is essentially a one-parameter subspace of the moduli space of the n equals 2 gauge theory. Now, we wanted to understand how this was related to the enhanceon, because it has an n equals 2, at least deep in the middle of the space-time. That's what's supposed to be dual to the n equals 2 field theory. So we wanted to find out, we were interested in this just all by itself, but we were also interested in the connection to the enhanceon phenomenon and the question of whether there's an enhanceon, whether there's a singularity, is it resolved, and so forth. Now, there's one comment that I would make, is that if you want to look at the singularities, you really have to look 10 dimensions. And certainly that's the case if you're making the geometry out of D-brains, because 10 dimensions is the natural dimension they sort of come from in the first place. You can compactify them and do all sorts of things with them, but if you want to understand singularity structure of the supergravity, you really look in 10. And the reason why that's a non-trivial statement is that if you wrap a brain, you do a compactification, the singularity structure can change. The question of whether a singularity is naked or not can depend on the dimension we're talking about. Well, if you take just plain Jane D3 brains in 10 dimensions and you ask what is the singularity structure of that space-time, we'll know that the near-horizon geometry is ADS5 times S5, and it's completely non-singular space-time, and it's geodesically complete and everything, whereas at D3 brain you wrap it on a 3 torus, then you find out that the singularity in 7 dimensions, there is actually a singularity in 7 dimensions, it's null. So the question is not, you know, just trivial as to where you should do the singularity analysis. Okay, so this calculation yielded a space-time which has a dilaton in 10 dimension that varies with the radius. This was a new feature. This 5-square squash, this complicated things turns on. But what I want here is that there is a parameter which parameterizes for the how much breaking there between the all going down to the n equals 2 supersymmetry, and there was another mysterious parameter k for them that was proportional to the ADS radius times the mass that we're using to break the supersymmetry. I'll just mention quickly about the symmetries in this geometry. The n equals 2 star theory has an SU2 cross U1 R symmetry. The easiest way to see this is to look at the fermions, which get acted on by this R symmetry in the fundamental. The third and fourth fermions, these are the ones that get the mass. There's only a leftover S2 or U1 mixing them up. Because 1 and 2 are still massless, so there's an SU2 here. If you ask how the scalars behave, the six of them, and they transform like so, and two of them can be seen to be invariant under this R symmetry. What this means for us is that there turns out to be a fixed plane in the supergravity solution where the radius of this squashed sphere goes to zero. Also, there's an angle, an azimuthal angle in this geometry on which this R symmetry doesn't act, and these angles on the sphere, of course, and the radius are, of course, related to these six scalars. And the fields depend on in a complicated way. There's also an orbital symmetry in this gravity approximation that wouldn't be there in the full string theory that leaves the mass perturbation invariant. And just to give you some sense of why it wasn't to do the calculations, this is just fields that occurred in here. There were some, you know, fields that depend on Cs and so forth that turned out to be related to the cosh of KL over R, and this would be the thing that you would recognize if you were doing anti-de Sitter space, looking at how it goes to ADS5 and S5 and infinity. There's also, you know, a non-trivial dilaton and an axion and lots of yucky forms turned on. One of the things I'd just like to draw your attention to is some notation that I'm using. Tau is thing that is a combination of 1 over the string coupling within the imaginary part, so that's dilaton piece, and then there's a theta angle as well. Just as to give a flavor. So, you know, this geometry is all very cool and it's great and nice, but what we wanted to know was what it was made of. Is it just a configuration of three brains, or does it have some other higher brain multipoles? And this was a non-trivial question because, at least in the Polchinski-Strassler story for the NX1 star theory, there were actually higher brain multipoles, and that was Meyer's dielectric effect, and it wasn't to understand what was happening. Well, what we found is that the source brains, the things giving rise to this Polk Warner geometry, were actually just simply the three brains. It was a bit of a surprise, and it's certainly not obvious when you start out. But it just happens once you start doing the analysis, and that's nice. The reason that all these funny, complicated fields end up being turned on is that they're arranged in a strange way. Not a lot they're actually made of, what's the distribution of brains, and how that relates to the enhancement story. Okay, so in order to figure out what the geometry is looking like, what we started out doing is probing it with what we imagined it was made of, which was D3 brains, and that turned out to be right. So we wrote down the probe action, and there's some complicated stuff, you know, pulling back the metric and the B field to the world volume. In this case, the field strength turned on the brains, and then there's a Wessamino term as well as the DBI term. Doing the probe analysis in 10 dimensions is very important. It's certainly much easier than trying to do it in a lower dimension. Hard, but in fact the analysis is simpler because many of the fields that occur up here are actually don't appear once you pull them back to the brain. There's also some cross terms in the phi form that are absent that makes it easier. And you can find pretty quickly what are the zeros of the potential energy. This gives you the moduli space, which you expect to be there because it's supposed to be in n equals 2 supersymmetric theory when you get down to the middle of the space-time. And you find how to represent that in terms of the coordinates that were given to us by Pilk and Warner. We actually found that we needed two coordinate patches for this fixed plane. But what I want you to draw from this is not the details, but the fact that the moduli space is two-dimensional, as you expect. And now we would like to what we'd like to find is the metric on that moduli space. And it won't be flat because we've got a complicated, less supersymmetric situation. So one of the things that is the case for the whole geometry that we're talking about is that it's dual to a theory that has at least n equals 2 supersymmetry, at least in the ultraviolet it has n equals 4, but everywhere there is at least an n equals 2 symmetry. So what we demanded is that we write the kinetic energy for the the coordinates on this moduli space. These are the fields, the transverse scalars, switch to a coordinate system which is natural for the n equals 2 symmetry, the n equals 2 supersymmetry. So the way to write this is that the kinetic energy is written as in terms of the imaginary part of our function that I talk about, the thing that's the combination of the dilaton and the axion, and that there was a velocity which you write as Vy for some y, and then Vy bar, and so you can just write it all in terms of some complex field y. And so you demand that you just write natural n equals 2 coordinates on the moduli space, and then you find what is this tau thingy. And of course, it does turn out to be a holomorphic function of y, as you expect. So, well, what we find, what you can find from this is how the distribution of brains looks, and actually the way we figured out the actual distribution of brains was compared to the gauge theory, and I should have time to talk about that in a minute. But one of the things we can do is ask about how this distribution of brains looks depending on what this parameter gamma is doing. And this gamma thing is supposed to describe how big is the breaking from n equals 4 to n equals 2. And in their parameterization, gamma equals 0 was the thing that was supposed to correspond to the most breaking that they could get with their solution. So what they found there was that, in fact, what we found, sorry, was that the circle in Polk-Warner coordinates, this is the thing that they thought was the ring of the enhanceon that we had found in our geometry, actually turns into a line segment once you switch to the coordinates natural for the n equals 2 structure. And so actually what the distribution of brains look like, they lie on this little cut. And the reason we know that there is actually an enhanceon there is that the kinetic energy of the probe goes to zero on the cut. And so we've got this, you know, bar distribution of brains. I'll just mention that this sounds somewhat similar to taking the Polchinski stressless story and collapsing one of the axes by turning off one of the mass parameters, but actually it's a completely a different limit to that one, because it actually corresponds to a different mass perturbation. So the kind of n equals 2 perturbation that Polk and Warner were doing is not one that can be then taken to the Polchinski-Strassler business. So what happens when you turn up the gamma parameter, or turn up its absolute value? In their case, turning down gamma is the thing that takes you away from the n equals 2. You reduce the breaking. If you send gamma to minus infinity, that corresponds to going back to n equals 4. But what you find in this case is on the coordinates that are natural, again, for this n equals 2 structure, the line segment unsquashes, and in fact, what you get back is the n equals 4 Coulomb branch problem when the brains are spread over a disk. And that was analyzed by some other people. So anyway, that's pretty much what happens. And just in the remaining few minutes, I'll just describe how we found out exactly what the distribution of the brains looked like on this little enhanceon. We're going to concentrate now on the situation that does have an enhanceon, just because it was the most interesting from our perspective. Okay, so just before I get onto the gauge theory story, let me summarize what happens from the point of view of the supergravity. What we found here was that actually the supergravity is non-singular in the string frame, and where there is an enhanceon, in the case of gamma equals zero, the distribution of the brains is actually as compact as possible. And that was something that we found in the spherically symmetric case that we analyzed just without the whole Polk-Warner perturbation story, that the brains got sort of spread out, but they only got spread out as far as needed in order to achieve the resolution, if you like. They didn't sort of spread out to be some other random place. Okay. So the way we identify the distribution of these source D3 brains that are giving rise to this big whole complicated space-time is to demand that that tau function, the thing that tells you about the dilaton axion field in supergravity, is the same as the tau function in supergravity. And so the way you look at it is, for example, we know we're in some sort of Coulomb vacuum here, and quantum mechanically this is always, there's no enhanced symmetry, is always broken down to a U1 to the number of rank of the gauge group minus 1, so we could let the VEVs be diagonal, a diagonal matrix of some A parameters. And then since we've got N minus 1 vector multiplets, we can write down a prepotential from the N equals 2 supersymmetry. There's a classical piece, a perturbative piece, and a non-perturbative piece. We can easily compute the perturbative piece. It's one loop exact, and you get it by integrating out charged so-called W bosons and hyper the non-perturbative guy is actually typically difficult to calculate at large n. It's important, however, only when you have light BPS states, when the eigenvalue spacings are less than order 1 over n. And in fact, when we're working in the supergravity regime, which is the thing that we were trying to analyze here, the instanton corrections are actually exponentially suppressed. So all you actually need is to do this perturbative calculation. When you go to strong, yes, indeed. All that you needed was that the eigenvalue separations were. Sorry, I'm just really tired. I don't know if I'm answering your question correctly. But yes, when you're working in the supergravity limit, that corresponds to strong Atoff coupling and one over n corrections, n going to infinity as well. And we could see that, in fact.
Well, it's enough for
suppressing. Right. So, how did we actually find the brain distribution? Well, suppose you added a probe, which is at some distance u. Then you have to change your matrix of VEVs to include the fact that you haven't just got the A's, but you've also got the U, and you need to subtract this little piece here just so that the holes are traceless. Then you can compute what it is, and it's basically the constant piece. And then there's of log coming from the perturbative one-loop calculation that involved this parameter U. What you could get off from this actually is Hansom. You can actually use that to decode exactly what the relationship is between their mystery parameter and ML, which was the breaking times the ADS radius. And in fact, if we match this story here in the limit where you can replace the sum by an integral, which you can do in the large, you can find by matching to the supergravity tau function that we computed in the natural n equals 2 coordinates, then you find, in fact, that it's a semicircle distribution of brains. Okay, this was nice to actually extract what it was here. I'm getting too technical. Let me just conclude that part. I can also mention that for this whole story of the Polk-Warner geometry, we actually were interested in turning on a non-commutativity parameter. Now, the reasons for this is checking out some properties of commutative gauge theories. In this case, you can actually, from the gauge theories, the phase for planar graphs is actually trivial for two derivative terms giving rise to the metric on moduli space, which was that one thing that we were computing. And you actually find that on the supergravity side, commutativity actually, as required, not mess up the moduli space. That's pretty much it. Questions?
Distribution of brains on a disk, is it something you put on or is
that? It comes out. So that's what happens when you take away the n equals 2 breaking parameter. In the Polk-Warner analysis, that was the gamma parameter. Mm-hmm. And when you dialed that to be minus infinity, you could actually see from the calculation that it did go over to the disk situation. It's sort of like you've got the squashed things on a line segment, and as soon as you open it up, it turns out to be a disk, not a ring, by the way. And it was important that we actually changed to the coordinates that were appropriate for the n equals 2 to actually see how that happened.
There are no solutions that can just split into rings.
Not with this solution. Now, the point is that if you ask about points on the gauge theory moduli space, well, not just points, there's whole,
many, many parameters. There's many ways that you can range the brains and so forth. But that was, actually, we thought that maybe some of the stuff from the gauge theory side would enable the supergravity, help the supergravity people to construct this, really mega work method, this consistent truncation ansatz, to actually compute some of the other geometries that would be relevant, that would be dual to these other places on the moduli space of the gauge theories. But it's a really hard problem, which I think is possibly why there's not been an awful lot more progress on it. Maybe other people in the audience know more than I do about that. We were interested in it, not just sort of unpacking it, trying to see what it was
in terms of three brains, and again, that was all done via this probe story, we were interested in seeing what the enhanceon looked like in this case. I should just mention that when we talked about the original enhanceon phenomenon as having a sort of a spherical symmetry, If you ask, is that generic from the gauge theory point of view, the answer is actually no. And after we wrote the paper, many people wrote to us and said, well, hang on a minute, there's many other solutions for the Seiberg-Witten curves. You know, there's other places on the gauge theory moduli space you can be other than just having them all living on this spherical. In the case of the 3 plus 1 gauge theory, it's a ring. You don't have to have all the brains sitting on this ring. One of the solutions is actually to have a smaller ring and a bigger ring, or you could have a non-spherically symmetric situation. So the reason that we picked the one that corresponded to the ring was it was just the most symmetrical situation, and we felt that it was the most likely to be related to the supergravity resolution of the singularities, but that's actually an interesting degeneracy that we didn't really analyze too much. So it's entirely possible that, you know, the enhanceon can actually look like a line segment and on some points of the gauge theory moduli space. So, as long as it's relevant to the talk.
Yeah. Thank you for the insight. Here it is. In gravitational collapse, the event horizon first develops in the center of the collapsing body. Okay?
If there is a horizon for the geometry, yes.
In Einstein's theory, okay, Schwarzschild interior solution gets the event horizon first develops in the center in the course of gravitational collapse.
Right, and how is that relevant to my talk?
How would that be? How would these higher dimensions affect that gravitational collapse? Would that result in some observable effects? I mean, we observe gravitational collapse. It's the only case where we get this very high energy.
Yeah, well, we can continue this discussion later. I don't think this question is actually related to the subject of my talk, so I will just postpone the answer until later. Yeah, I know. We've banged heads before, and I don't want to spend too much time answering just one question.
It's not an answer.
I know.
I'm still puzzled about this pushing out of the brains.
Yes.
Let's see. In the solution that you construct, you just assume that the brains are some homogeneous source of Ramon flux, and there's no sort of discreteness.
In the supergravity approximation, you don't expect to be able to see that discreteness because that would be a 1 over n effect.
Right. Okay. So,
and the 1 over n goes to zero limit, the brains are sort of densely packed on this sphere.
Right. But now if I dump energy in, and
yes,
I'm getting some horizon radius, which is bigger and bigger,
uh-huh,
and the brain source is pushed further and further outside the horizon, wouldn't I expect at some point to see a situation where I the radius must reach some scale at which the inner brain spacing is aborted, the distance between the enhanceon and the horizon? At that point, I think I might expect that it would be like looking at an individual six brain that sees a Schwarzschild horizon and it wants to fall in. I mean, is that...
We actually haven't looked too hard at the high temperature limit as yet, so that would be an interesting question. Yeah, I don't know the answer, but yeah, if it is indeed true that you can sort of push it to be bigger and bigger and bigger, then
I'm just sort of wondering whether there should be some sources of instability.
Right, and I think I think that the question of just, again, what's the highest entropy situation will clearly depend, well, it should depend on the temperature for this reason, yeah.
Any other questions? Let's do the speaker.